is some picks.
Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan here with yet another episode of The Pick Show. I am joined here this week by the voice of Bellator MMA, the co-author of Is This Legal with Art Davey about the origins and everything surrounding the first UFC, as well as now the co-host of the Let's Get It On podcast with Big John McCarthy, and that is the one and only Sean Wheelock. How are you doing?
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on the program.
My pleasure. Actually, you were one of the people that when I started, I kind of just wanted to have you on because I had a feeling it would be fun. So, because I know you've been watching wrestling going back. How long? When do you remember starting wrestling? Just to get right in. Starting watching wrestling.
Probably when I was 5 or 6 years old, and that aligned with still the great period of the NWA. I caught the closing stages of the NWA, which was the 1980s. Mm-hmm. But from probably 1980 or 81, I started going down as a very little kid to Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas, one of the great wrestling buildings in the world. And Bob Geigel, Harley Race were, of course, the main principals in the Central States promotion. Harley Race, obviously a multiple-time NWA world champion. Bob Geigel, a great wrestler in his own right and a multiple-time NWA president. Every Thursday night at Memorial Hall, and I mean every Thursday night, they would have a show. And even as a little kid, I learned that you would go on every other Thursday because that was the television taping. So you would see some title fights, Central States tag team titles, or you would see the Central States heavyweight championship, which usually involved some combination of Rufus R. Jones, Bruiser Bob Sweetan, or Bulldog Bob Brown. And then you had all of these visiting wrestlers, top name wrestlers from other NWA circuits. So it wasn't uncommon to see Tommy Wildfire Rich or the Von Erichs or Buzz Sawyer. And then you would see some real big barnstorming talent who literally would go around, not be holding any promotion. Andre the Giant would pass through once or twice a year. I saw Giant Baba, Ox Baker, right after I saw Escape from New York, which is a huge thrill for me as a very small child. I didn't realize until I got to be an adult and really started to try to focus in on the history of NWA wrestling in this late 70s and all through the 80s, really to the end of what it was, that I realized just how privileged I was to see these huge stars. Because the Central States in their own right, David, as you well know, and a lot of the people listening know, they had an incredible roster of talent. But because of the cachet in that industry of Bob Geigel and Harley Race, to be able to just get Kerry Von Erich to come and wrestle on a random Thursday night on local television in a 2,200-seat building, it's just phenomenal that Andre the Giant would come through. There would always be the big Thanksgiving show. They would always have a 20-man battle royal. And, I mean, it was superstars. It was literally a who's who of NWA. My claim to fame as a mark is – when Ric Flair first won the NWA heavyweight championship, and what a different era that it wasn't even on television. It was a televised card in Kansas City. I don't know what happened to the tape. So it was televised locally on the old Channel 41 UHF station in Kansas City. But Ric Flair defeated Dusty Rhodes to win his first NWA title. And I was a very small child, and I can still recreate that match for you, including the finish. It was amazing. And I remember Dusty Rhodes limping out after he had dropped the title, and he walked right past me, and he just looked devastated. He looked like he was about to cry, and it was such an emotional moment for a very small little mark.
Wow. And that was considered kind of unusual at the time because I don't think there were any other NWA world title changes in Kansas City. I mean, usually it was places like Houston or Toronto or Tokyo, kind of, or St. Louis, of course, which was considered kind of the capital city of the NWA. But those were usually kind of where they tried to have the title changes. Also, maybe places like Florida, too. But that, I guess, the Kansas City territory was sort of a considered a smaller territory, but for various reasons, like you had Harley Race owning part of it and being the big star there, and also the relative proximity to St. Louis, like you said, you did have a lot of big stars come through. And I guess, look, trying to remember, and as you said, you were pretty young back then, so I don't know exactly how much you'd remember around it. Was there anything that would have made you think that it was going to be a title change in advance?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, I mean, I'm talking now, you know, when I'm 6, 7, 8 years right. old. I went all the way through my high school years, but it was cool. I mean, it was a world title fight. And oftentimes when Ric Flair came in, or when Harley Race would defend the title, or Dusty Rhodes, I'm a little too young for the Funk Brothers, but that was kind of my era of NWA heavyweight champions. When I first started going and following, going to Memorial Hall, you would get a lot of those 60-minute draws where it was the local hometown hero who probably was holding the Central States title at the time. So more often than not, that would be Rufus R. Jones or Bulldog Bob Brown. Bruiser Bob Sweetan was always a heel, but the other two were largely faces. And just as they finally caught the world champion in a pinfall and the hand was about to slap three, the bell would ring, and that was 60 minutes and the time had expired. I mean, it's unthinkable now, really, that you're going to see a 60-minute draw in professional wrestling, but those happened with pretty frequent, a pretty high level of frequency, those 60-minute draws, and they were so frustrating. I read Ric Flair's autobiography, and he talked about the envy he had that in the WWF, whether it was Bob Backlund or Hulk Hogan or when it was Bruno Sammartino, kind of the way it worked is the champion would go in and they would smash the challenger. But just because of the satellite territories of the NWA, it was expected that the champion would go in and he wouldn't just smash. It wouldn't just be a squash against the hometown hero. They would really be put to it. And Flair talked about in his book that he was envious because the champions of the NWA, by and large, were not meant to look good. They were going to hold on to the title, but they were really there to serve the hometown hero, to serve the local star or that local regional promotion champion. Other way around than the old WWF. Totally different now in the WWE, but I think that really shows the difference in philosophy of those two organizations in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it's usually described is that most of the different territorial promotions were babyface territories. They were heel territories because it would be around the babyface kind of working to conquer the heel, and they'd have to keep working at it. And there would, you know, they'd be trying to chase a heel champion or a heel NWA champion or whatever. WWF or WWF, you always had that hero on top and being fairly dominant.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you look at Hulkamania, but really, I mean, with the two title runs of Bruno Sammartino, I mean, he was the most loved fighter in the promotion, and he's also the unbeatable world champion who's squashing his opponents by and large.
Right. So I guess I want to ask you about some of the local top stars, because of course you had Harley Race, but you also had Bulldog Bob Brown and Rufus R. Jones, and those guys aren't always looked at through the most rose-colored glasses from people outside of Kansas City. So I was wondering if you could kind of give me an idea of, like, as someone who grew up with, you know, Bulldog Bob Brown, Rufus R. Jones had a little more success outside the area, but, like, what kind of appeal did they have to you as a kid growing up?
They were just our stars. It probably would be the equivalent if you're a kid who grows up in a town with single-A baseball, mm-hmm. and that's all you watch. You think that those are the best players in the world. You don't really understand out. And I'm a child of the 80s, so I'm a kid who got cable, thankfully, to my mom at a very young age. So I was watching those WWF when they were WWF shows from Madison Square Garden, and occasionally from Landover, Maryland, which was with the Cap Center, where the Washington Capitals played. Yeah. They would be on USA Network. I was a huge, huge fan of Georgia Championship Wrestling. For a while, we got the shows from Texas, so the Von Erich shows, the Cowboy Bill Watts shows. And then when I was in junior high, and then later into the 80s, we started getting the AWA shows on ESPN. But Bulldog Bob Brown, to me, he was just as good as watching Bob Backlund or watching Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair or Harley Race. I didn't see a difference. And they were Kansas City guys, even though Bulldog Bob Brown was from Canada. None of them were local. They became local guys. So as a kid, I thought Bulldog Bob Brown was on the same level as George Brett or Frank White to me. This is a hometown star. I knew that he lived in the city, and that was my guy. So Bulldog Bob Brown, Bruiser Bob Sweetan, as we said, Mike George, Colonel Buck Robley. That's a name kind of lost to history. Marty Jannetty started there. The stars that came through, it's amazing. So many of the wrestlers just parked in the Central States territory. I guess the money must have been good enough and the travel wasn't that bad because you're driving 2, 3, 4 hours at most. They just parked there. They didn't look to use that as a springboard into a bigger territory or to switch promotions. They were just there. And maybe that was the loyalty to Bob Geigel and Harley Race, but Bulldog Bob Brown was there when I started watching on TV all the way through to the end. Same with Rufus R. Jones. They were just the guys who were always there, always on the rosters. Fighters would come and go. Wrestlers would come and go. But there were always those core stable of Central States guys.
Right. And a lot of those guys were really talented and are really underrated, but I think don't get a lot of credit because maybe they didn't spend as much time in some of like the territories that had national TV or syndicated TV or whatever. Like Mike George, from what I've seen, I always thought he was really, really good. Or Bob Sweetan too, especially like I really loved. He had a feud with Ted DiBiase when he was in Mid-South Wrestling. That was just tremendous. And you also got to see Harley Race as a babyface, which no one else really would have gotten to see. I mean, what do you remember about him, and then kind of comparing him to, I guess, when you would have seen him as a heel in other areas? Like, what did you think of how he was as a babyface?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, but I'm a little too young for his face days. So when he was in and out of Central States, mm-hmm. remember, even though he was a co-owner of that promotion, whether he was an NWA world champion at the time or not, he was never parked in Central States. He would wrestle there a lot and he would show up a lot or special guest referee or just be there. Mm. But he wasn't a house wrestler the way that, as we said, like Sweetan and George and yeah. Brown and guys like mm-hmm. that were Rufus R. Jones. I always remembered him, though, as a heel.
Okay.
Whether he had the title or not, he was always a heel, and he always kind of had that sinister quality. And it's funny, as I've met him, I can't claim a friendship or that I know him very mm-hmm. well, but as I've met him and gotten to know him a little bit, what a nice man he is, but I still can't kind of shake that image of me as a six-year-old kid thinking, wow, this guy is really tough. This is a real rough guy. So when he turned face, it was already imprinted into my brain that this was a heel. And I understood that he was from Kansas City, but he never, to me, had the same quality of the local guys. And at the time, I had no idea who owned the promotion. I never even thought in that direction. But more often than not, he was the guy who was the world champion, or he was out chasing the world champion around the NWA, around the country.
Yeah. And you mentioned that a lot of guys came through there, that it was one of those places where just a lot of people, just when they first started out, like Marty Jannetty, Shawn Michaels, Scott Hall. I know I'm forgetting a bunch of people, but just a lot of guys came through there. I mean, is there anyone that you remember seeing and thinking, oh, whether they did become a big star or they didn't, thinking that, oh, this guy's going to be the biggest thing in wrestling or just something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, Jannetty and Shawn Michaels, they were the Midnight Express. And at the time in the 80s, we had the indoor team, the Kansas City Comets, who were routinely drawing 14, 15, 16,000 a home game at Kemper Arena. And it's the theme song. It's so cheesy 70s music, but the theme song from the Oliver Stone film Midnight Express, where the guy is thrown in the Turkish prison for drug smuggling. And if you can think of it, it's that pulsating synthesizer late 70s music.
Dunna, dunna, dunna,
that's
dunna.
Exactly it. And so that was the Kansas City Comets, and that's what Jannetty and Michaels used too. I just remember those guys feeling different. They looked better. They moved better. They were younger. Always as a kid, a lot of the house guys seemed like old men, probably because they were old men. But these were the first two guys who seemed like they were young. I don't know how old they were at the time. They were probably early to mid 20s, I'm guessing, in the late 80s, maybe very early 20s. But the both of them, and I actually thought that Jannetty, more so of the two, would be the bigger star. They just kind of had a special quality. And looking back now, that maybe was starting to be a turning point of what the NWA was doing. Clearly, the WWF at the time had already embraced that, but maybe that was kind of the first wave of that philosophy in the NWA.
Yeah, in terms of, what do you mean? In terms of like embracing like more, a little bit more flashiness and stuff
more
like that?
More flashiness, more entrances, better costumes, just having a better physique, just moving better, more aerial stunts, things like that. Yeah. Not so much the big 240-pound guy who's 30 pounds overweight with a huge gut, just kind of doing these plodding moves, mm-hmm. which I still loved, by the way.
And so one of the other guys that's associated a lot with Kansas City, he wasn't a guy who lived there and was there on every show, but someone who came through a lot was Bruiser Brody.
All the time, Bruiser Brody, all the time. And it's funny, Memorial Hall, I've actually commentated MMA there and I've refereed boxing there. Refereeing boxing Memorial Hall is one of the highlights of my life, believe me, being in that dressing room. But it's such a small, intimate building. And there were two dressing rooms. One side were for the heels. The other side were for the faces. And you could stand without security guards literally right outside of the dressing room door. So they would open and out would come Bruiser Brody or Ric Flair or Ted DiBiase. And Bruiser Brody, he and the Great Kabuki probably terrified me as a small child more than any other two wrestlers. I mean, they never broke character. And knowing Bruiser Brody's life, I think he became Bruiser Brody in real life. Unfortunately, he had a tragic end to it. But when he would come through and storming out, there was that unpredictability to it, which I loved. And also, you know, this is an era where people bled all the time.
Yeah.
He was a big bleeder. And Terry Funk, even though I didn't see him as a world champion, but I saw Terry Funk plenty of times, huge bleeder. Guys would juice and just open up all the time, which I think if you're listening to this and you're age 30 or younger, that's probably tough to imagine, but it was really bloody, especially those non-televised or those locally televised shows.
Yeah, and it's so weird now that it's kind of disappearing. It's like I miss kind of what it brought to wrestling, but I kind of don't have any desire to see anyone do it again.
You know, it's probably like a different era. You know, we could be on this program talking about in basketball before the jump shot and the slam dunk, or talking about football when they had leather helmets and no shoulder pads. It's just a different era. It was a different time. You know, they never broke kayfabe, which I loved. I mean, strict. Never break kayfabe. No matter what you do, you're going to be in character all the time, which I'm a huge fan of Andy Kaufman. And look, that's why Andy Kaufman gravitated towards pro wrestling, because he would get into character as Foreign Man or as Tony Clifton, and he wouldn't break it. And that's what he saw with Jerry the King Lawler. And when he fell in with wrestling, that whole ethos of kayfabe and you're not going to have lunch with someone, you're not going to ride in the same car, you keep that all the way. So when you're Bruiser Brody and you're coming out of that dressing room door and you want to terrorize a 7-year-old Sean Wheelock, go ahead. That's the thing. Did you think that this can go wrong at any time? And, you know, it really, and I know this from writing Is This Legal and doing the research, deep research on this. You know, the turning point, I think a lot of people listening probably realize this, David, I'm sure you do, but the turning point was when Vince McMahon Jr. did not want to pay the New York State Athletic Commission for his shows and said, look, guys, we're not a sport. Stop regulating us. We're sports entertainment. And that was really the end of kayfabe. That was the split between then and now in pro wrestling.
Yeah, in terms of it being directly acknowledged by the promoters, yeah. I mean, you always, you know, you look back, like, and I recently was looking at there's someone I know that put up all like these old newsletters that have clippings of old articles online, and you see going back decades that, you know, there were all, everyone always knew and there were always articles about it, but then all of a sudden you have the promoter saying it, and that's a very, very, very different thing. And from there, you know, it just kind of changed to where it is now, which it's a different thing. I think there are benefits to it, to just saying this is a show and treating it like it's any other show, but it without having that mystique, it's always going to be missing something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know how many people who watched pro wrestling in the 70s and the 80s understood that it was predetermined in the outcome, but probably the closest comparison is what's going on in Japan with Strong Style, is that, look, the winner and loser are predetermined, but they're still roughing it up pretty good. And if you talk to somebody of Harley Race's generation, they'll let you know that they roughed it up pretty good. I've always found it fascinating that wrestlers of that era have no respect for guys who don't really know how to wrestle. And it's an interesting concept, because why do you need to know how to wrestle? Why do you need to know how to shoot? Well, just in case. And that was always the knock on Hulk Hogan from the guys a generation before him. Hey, he's just a gimmick. He really can't shoot. He can't wrestle. He didn't need to, but he was viewed differently from someone like Pat O'Connor or Lou Thesz or Harley Race or Vern Gagne, who, if it really went down and it might just go down, look out, because these guys are going to put it on you.
Right. I mean, going back to Harley Race, got his first world title is sort of an insurance thing, because it was when Dory Funk Jr. was supposed to lose the title to Jack Briscoe. Dory Funk had he claimed he had a truck accident on his ranch and delayed the match, and somehow and like there was a doctor's note, but everyone was kind of skeptical of it, and then he ended up somehow postponing it so he would lose it to Harley Race, and Harley won it for a few months, and then he lost it to Jack Briscoe. And there was some whole weird thing with how the Funks didn't want to lose it to someone from Oklahoma, and I'm not from that part of the country, so I could never understand that whole thing.
It was so politicized, too, and there are some very good books out now to see about, you know, it was a big deal to be the world champion. It was such an honor, and you had to put down a security deposit. They were afraid someone would run off with the belt. And, you know, even into the 50s with double crosses back when – and, David, I know you know this, with the era of 2 out of 3 falls and the double crosses where, all right, we're going to predetermine that the champion wins the first fall, drops the second fall, wins on the third fall, and the double cross would come somehow. Something happened in the third fall, and you lose the belt. So – there was a necessity, I guess, why guys really had to be able to shoot. And guys just had different backgrounds. If you look at wrestlers under the age of 30, what they come out of is so much different from what wrestlers came out of in the 1970s and the 1960s and the 1930s.
Yeah, and one of the all-time legendary stories with that is when Bearcat Wright was the champion in California, and he had been a boxer, so he had decided he didn't want to lose the title all of a sudden for whatever reason. He kind of was one of those guys who could cause trouble and all that. But he was, you know, very big draw, so he became the champion. But then he decided he didn't want to lose it. And Freddie Blassie, he was like, oh, I'm friends with him. I'll talk to him. We'll do a match, and he'll drop the title to me. Well, he punches out Fred Blassie. And then I forget who they announced he was going to be wrestling. But they told him he was going to be wrestling someone else. He walks to the ring. Who does he see but Gene LaBelle? And he just walked out and never lost the title.
A story that I know from the late Scott Ledoux, who was top 10 in the world in boxing as a heavyweight in the 70s and then turned in the 1980s to pro wrestling when he was done with boxing, told me a story that – and he wrestled in the AWA – that Scott Ledoux, being a former boxer, his finishing move was a right hand. And he wrestled One Man Gang, and it was determined that he would throw the right hand, knock out One Man Gang, pin him, and get the win. And Scott Ledoux told me that One Man Gang immediately got up, walked back, didn't sell it. And that really upset Scott Ledoux and upset all the other wrestlers. So they said, you need to sort this out. A couple nights later, different city, same two, Ledoux and One Man Gang, same finish. Ledoux throws the right hand, but really turns it over and knocked out One Man Gang. Scott Ledoux told me this story for about 20 or 25 minutes. I don't think you have that level of justice of self-policing anymore in pro wrestling.
No.
That's where it was so different then. You better go along with the script. You better behave. You better play by these rules. You better follow kayfabe.
Yeah, and by the way, as we were talking just now, I looked up to see with inflation how much the NWA title deposit would be now, because I think it was always something like in the 27,000 range, maybe 25,000.
Right.
That's well over $100,000 in today's money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's close to 150,000.
Yeah, it was such an honor, too, because you have the president of the NWA and then the heads or the presidents of all of these regional territories, Mid-South and Georgia and California and central states, and they're all voting. You're really being elected to this position for a host of different reasons, and what an incredible honor. It wasn't just who's the hottest guy at the moment or who can we sell the most of these products on. It was really an honor. And the champion was meant to be treated differently in that era.
And somehow I realized this might be a good transition now to move into MMA a little, because I was thinking about how because I wasn't exactly sure where the Scott LaDuce story was going to go. I had an idea, but it got me thinking about how you'll hear stories sometimes from wrestlers who a fan attacks them, and when they try to fight back, not thinking about it, they'll throw a working punch. Like, because it's just what they're used to. And so I was kind of curious, you know, now that Bellator's had a few fighters who either experimented with pro wrestling like King Mo did, or is a working pro wrestler like Bobby Lashley. Have you spoken to them? Like, have they had any issues with the transition at all? Because, like, the thing that you kept hearing with Bobby Lashley kind of deciding to do both side by side was that you can't, that a lot of people think you can't do it effectively if you're doing both kind of together, as opposed to doing wrestling for a few months, taking a break, doing a training camp, etc.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge mark or a smark, whatever, but I'm still a huge mark. So King Mo, but much more Bobby Lashley, because King Mo is as much of a mark as I am. Huge pro wrestling fan, kind of found himself in it, where Bobby Lashley, of course, after being a three-time NAIA national champion in wrestling for Missouri Valley College, then goes into pro wrestling. What I found from Lashley, what I found from King Mo, I've talked to Josh Barnett, who's had a lot of strong style pro wrestling matches in Japan. The emphasis for them is on protecting your opponent, working as a team. It's almost like talking about a dance partner, right? That it's imperative you do not hurt. They're more concerned about their opponent's safety than they are about their own safety. And that's the mindset. It's making this look good, but protecting my opponent. I cannot get this person hurt, which obviously you have to flip the switch in a 180-degree direction when you're an MMA fighter. And they also talk about the athleticism. And I think a lot of people who dismiss pro wrestling, people always have dismissed pro wrestling in the era of kayfabe and now in this postmodern era, they dismiss it. It's a joke. These guys are highly athletic. They have to move. They have to work. And, you know, earlier we were talking about those old 60-minute matches. Can you imagine the amount of energy you would have to expend, especially as a man over 220 pounds, to wrestle nonstop for 60 minutes? It's insane.
Yeah, it's weird. It reminds me I think it was some argument about whether or not certain wrestler who was like a bigger guy, whether or not he was in good shape in terms of just moving around, even if he wasn't in the best, you know what I mean? Like, even if it was someone who was overweight, and it was like, the person who said he wasn't in shape, like, someone came back and I'm kind of saying, well, I mean, even though it's not a real contest, you can't, like, if this person is having this, you know, give and take match for 20 minutes, half an hour, you can't really say that they're completely out of shape, because it's not, the movements and stuff are the same as if they were actually doing it. Doing a competitive match.
Absolutely. You know, and wrestling has changed so much now with the emphasis in ring, forgetting the presentation and the interviews, the emphasis in ring is so different. But even if you go back and you watch tapes from the 90s, how much jujitsu is in there, how much judo is in there, how much catch wrestling is in there, freestyle, Greco, folk style. You know, if you think about a hammerlock is not that far away from a kimura, you know? If you look at it sitting back for a figure four, you can find elements of an ankle lock, of a knee bar, of a heel hook in there. Boston Crab. I was training in my grappling class on Wednesday, and the guy actually tried to put me in a half Boston Crab. Luckily, I knew the escape. But, you know, there was a lot of that DNA of catch wrestling from those days, and you can see those elements, which is probably why it was so seamless to transition in Japan, going from the era of strong style into MMA, even the worked MMA bouts of the early and mid-90s into what it's become today.
Now, my understanding is a lot of people do this, so it's not embarrassing to say you have, but have you or anyone you've rolled with ever tried to pull off a figure four in jiu-jitsu class?
So my good friend Corey Smith, who is the producer of Invicta, producer-director of Invicta, and we worked together on M1, and I worked with him on a million soccers. He actually can put on a figure four. Now, it doesn't hurt, but he knows the step over and he knows the technique. It doesn't hurt at all. But I tried to put somebody in a surfboard once in jiu-jitsu, and that did not – it was a white belt, and I thought I could do it. That did not work well at all. But there's some levels of functionality. If you can catch somebody in a Boston Crab or a half Boston Crab, there's a work in there. Look, a twister is not that far away from an abdominal stretch. There are elements. But, yeah, I'm desperate to use a figure four or an Indian deathlock, for that matter, going back to the funks.
So are we just talking a regular behind the guy pulling on his arm surfboard? Or did you actually try to pull off a like a Mexican pulling the guy upside down surfboard.
No, I took the back instead of putting a rear naked choke. I put my knee in the back and I hooked his arms and I tried to pull back. But all you have to do is sit through. It's a pretty easy escape. We were just having fun. It wasn't that serious.
My understanding though was the figure four actually did work if you were able to get it on.
I could see. I know the mechanics of it, and it would probably be closer to a knee bar than a straight ankle lock or a heel hook if you're putting some pressure on the knee. But it's a tricky move. I'm still waiting for somebody in MMA to pull that off for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see some videos. Like there was a clip of Anderson Silva pulling it off during like it. I think the other guy knew that he was going to do it during a. Some kind of like, oh, I think it was when he did one of those like charity seminars that he's done. And it was coming out of the was it Delhiva Guard is what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of quickly put it on to the guy. Because I guess if there's going to be a position in jiu-jitsu that you would do it out of, that would be it.
You think about, though, like the Ted DiBiase figure four or the Ric Flair.
Oh, with the spinning toe holds.
The spinning, you're capturing the ankle, you're playing to the crowd. That might be a little tough to pull off. But again, I mean, look, the figure four just didn't show up. There was something in there from catch wrestling from probably the late 1800s or early 1900s. It's probably some variation of a knee bar.
Right. Also, what you mentioned with the Kimura, you know, obviously people forget, not only was Kimura a pro wrestler, but I always forget the actual quote, but Billy Robinson was always, like, complaining to people. Like, I forget who specifically he said taught it to him, but it was something like, it's a double wrist lock. We taught him the Kimura. We taught it to Kimura. That type of thing.
It's just whoever can popularize it or whoever makes it look the coolest. I don't think the Gracie family invented the guard.
Probably not.
I hate to bust a lot of myths here, but yeah, there you go.
So when it comes to, I mean, before we get to MMA, so I mean, I know you've been a big boxing fan for a long time. Were you into kickboxing at all back during its sort of like the American kickboxing heyday back in the 80s with the PKA stuff or anything like that?
I went to a few at Memorial Hall. It never really spoke to me. I remember as a small kid, my dad taking me, and the fact that you had to kick 10 times, I didn't understand that. I didn't like it. And
does anyone understand that rule?
I guess it's to keep just straight boxing ringers out.
I guess so, yeah.
But and then the long silky pants. But we had a lot of good boxing in Kansas City. I mean, we went from Tony Chiaverini into Tommy the Duke Morrison and Craig Cummings, who was top 10 in the world. So Kansas City was always very much a boxing town and a pro wrestling town. One of the highlights of my year when I was a little kid, all the way through high school and even into my early 20s until they finally banned it, were Tough Man contests, again, at Memorial Hall. Those crazy one-minute beatdowns, guys who were just brawlers by and large, who didn't know how to box, didn't know how to fight, put them in 20-ounce gloves, 3 one-minute rounds. Some of the worst beatings I've ever seen in my life took place in Tough Man. Mercifully, they ended those. But yeah, kickboxing, never so much. I truthfully never heard of Muay Thai. I had no idea what Muay Thai was. Didn't even know what the words meant until I started watching the early UFCs. Then I understood what Muay Thai was. But even jiu-jitsu, I put it in my book, honestly, I'd never heard of jiu-jitsu until November 12th, 1993, when I settled in and watched UFC 1. Very foreign concepts to me. I knew wrestling, I knew boxing, I knew there was something called kickboxing, which I'd seen a few times. I knew the different disciplines of wrestling. I mean, I am a Midwesterner after all, so I understood folk style, freestyle, Greco. But beyond that, it was like karate, and then there was this thing, kung fu, and that was about the depth of my fighting knowledge.
You know, since you bring it up, why do you think that it seems like there's a disconnect, at least from maybe from MMA fans, unless they're like super hardcore, it seems like a lot of people don't realize that that the American collegiate folk style wrestling is not the same thing as freestyle. Like, I don't even know. I'll just say it. I think it wasn't until like a few years ago, maybe around when Lesnar was in UFC, that I actually realized it was a separate thing.
Probably because that's by and large what you see. And if you're a kid, if you wrestle in high school, if you're serious and you're going to camps, they'll put you in a freestyle or a Greco camp. But if you're wrestling in junior high and high school and college, you're doing folk style. And most people are exposed to wrestling, either doing it as a kid or watching your kid or somebody else's kid. So it looks pretty similar to the untrained eye or even to the trained eye. Greco looks a lot different, but folk style and freestyle are pretty close. So most people are only going to see freestyle in the U.S. every 4 years on TV in the Olympics. It's so close that I just don't think people really recognize a difference, whereas Greco looks pretty foreign, and you see right. the difference in that. But yeah, I've heard it said by a lot of MMA fighters and MMA coaches, and I agree. Of the three, folk style, freestyle, and Greco, the one that lends itself most naturally to MMA is folk style wrestling, which is a theory why so many American and Canadian kids have done well in MMA, where a lot of Eastern Europeans and wrestlers from countries that emphasize more freestyle or Greco maybe don't have the same level of success in pro MMA.
Yeah, right, because just there's such a so much more mat work that isn't in absolutely. Freestyle. Yeah, and I think we may be starting to see a little bit more success from freestyle wrestlers, especially now. Well, I guess maybe non-American freestyle wrestlers would be the better way to put it, because if someone like a Daniel Cormier would have come up doing the folk style in school.
Well, see, and that's the thing. If you're talking about who are the dominant wrestlers in MMA right now? King Molawal, Ben Askren, Daniel Cormier, even if you go back with Randy Couture, Dan Severn, Dan Henderson, Heath Sims, all these guys had success at the international level. Joe Warren, but they made their names as collegiate wrestlers, as Division I national champions or Division I All-Americans. We're talking about Bobby Lashley, three-time NAIA national champion in folk style. Jimmy Smith, who knows a lot more about wrestling than just about anybody on the planet, not pro wrestling, not the kayfabe, but international wrestling. Crazy, watches the NCAAs. He's hardcore on it. He said part of it, too, if you win a gold medal or even a bronze medal in a country like Iran or Turkey or Russia, you're probably set for life. You're a huge celebrity. So you don't then need to find a second career in MMA, where somebody like Ben Askren goes to the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And I think he got a $20,000 a year job as the third assistant for Arizona State University. So even if he had won a gold medal, what really does Ben Askren get? What does a gold medal mean to an American wrestler? Probably not that much. Maybe you get to do a lot of camps and clinics and you'll get an assistant coaching job somewhere. But if you're Russian or you're Turkish or Iranian, it means a great deal. It means a change in life. It's probably like winning the World Cup or getting a Super Bowl ring, I would imagine.
Well, that kind of almost lends itself to what I was going to say next, which is that Yoel Romero seems to kind of be setting a template for how to use freestyle in an MMA context.
Yeah, I think it's very fair to say, absolutely. He's probably the best example right now.
But he's someone who comes from Cuba, who then fled to the U.S. because, I guess, part of... And who wouldn't have had those opportunities necessarily from, even though Cuba seems to do something of a good job in at least kind of trying to get its athletes ready. You know, I mean, we have at least two very high level MMA fighters who were Cuban Olympians who it seems like got out of Cuba as soon as they could, and Romero and also. Hector Lombard. Yeah, just the name just kind of got out of my head for a second. Yeah, and so you see guys who don't. So you're seeing someone who didn't have the opportunities that someone from Eastern Europe or Iran or
right. Well,
whatever
yeah, you think about somebody like Matt Lindland, who won a silver medal in 2000 in Sydney in the Olympics. If Matt Lindland walks into a $2 million a year coaching job and is doing seminars and getting all these endorsements. Does he then go try to learn this new sport called MMA? Probably not. They're almost doing it out of necessity because, again, I mean, if you're retired as a wrestler, you're probably going to go coach wrestling. And unless you're at one of the elite schools, Oklahoma State, Iowa State, Penn State, Arizona State, how much does it pay? I mean, Missouri, which is about a 2.5-hour drive to the east of where I'm sitting, has one of the top wrestling programs in the country. I don't know how much the head coach of Missouri makes. I'll bet it's not a ton, and I'll bet his number two assistant makes under $50,000 a year, probably under $30,000 a year. It's not a ton of money in that sport.
And Matt Lindland's a great example because he's a guy, and I'm using this in the nicest way possible, is a kind of who kind of had to hustle along the way to really make a good living for himself in MMA with coaching, with setting up gyms, with all sorts of, with management, with all sorts of different things to try to kind of just set up as many different ways for him, you know, to kind of make money as he could within MMA. And I think you probably part of that comes from that he's, you know, he won a silver medal and really didn't have anything to show for it professionally.
You know, in writing Is This Legal with Art Davey about how Art created the UFC up through the first UFC, and Art was desperate to get a boxer. And he thought, wow, could Mike Tyson was in prison at the time in Indiana, but George Foreman, Evander Holyfield, Lennox Lewis. You know, Art Jimerson wound up taking $17,000 as a cruiserweight, but Art Davey thought, even if I could raise $100,000, what's $100,000 to somebody like Evander Holyfield in 1993, who's coming off of a $40 million fight versus George Foreman? They got Art Jimerson because Art Jimerson was a cruiserweight and $17,000 was a lot of money, but so often the obvious answer is money, is that economic necessity drives or doesn't drive somebody to do or not do something. The reason that you're not going to see the Klitschko brothers suddenly find themselves in MMA is because they don't need to. Floyd Mayweather Jr. is not going to suddenly go to MMA because he doesn't need to. People are doing it largely out of economic necessity. MMA is a way for them to make more money, not to work very hard and make a lot less money.
Right, and because I don't think you did mention, just for those who don't know, Art Emerson, who was basically there to be the boxer in the first UFC, he was a very legitimate ranked boxer at the time. So,
and as a cruiserweight though, and you know we put this in the book, the cruiserweights, well, yes, that dead zone. So you're too big to be a middleweight or even a light heavyweight. So people say you're slow, but you're not powerful enough to be a heavyweight. So $17,000 was a lot, but James Bonecrusher Smith asked for $100,000. Leon Spinks asked for $100,000. You know, and these – I mean, really, James Bonecrusher Smith, he fought Mike Tyson, but he was a minor – I don't want to say a minor boxer. That's not fair. He was an outside of the top 15 boxer with some name, but he's asking for $100,000. So to talk about getting an A-level guy, good luck. It's just not going to happen.
Right. I would think he was the absolute best case scenario of getting a legitimate guy for something that fit in their budget.
Yeah, and we put this in the book, but only two fighters in the first UFC were given appearance fees. Jimerson got $17,000, and Taylor Tooley, the sumo wrestler, got $6,000. Everything else was just prize money.
So, yeah, let's talk about the book a little bit, which I recommend to definitely any MMA fan, and even if you're someone who's not into MMA that much, whether just mostly into pro wrestling or whatever, it is not and this is a credit to you and Art, that it is not a book that would just appeal to MMA fans if they just saw it and read it. I mean, it's an easy read in the sense that, you know what I mean, in the way that that is a compliment. It is just
– I really appreciate that. No, thank you. I mean, I wanted it to be an easy, fast read. Thank you very much for saying that.
It just tells the whole story very well, and I think one of the things that I found most interesting, if not the most interesting part, was seeing that Art Davey had been – this was not just a whim for him, that this has been something he had been looking into for years. Really going back decades to either hearing about or occasionally seeing like some kind of mixed match while he was in the military and then doing all this research. And he did his – you know, you did your research, you know, more recently when you were doing the book, and it's a lot easier these days. But this was late 80s, early 90s that he, I'm trying to remember because he named it in the book. He was using some maybe similar to a LexisNexis type search to get information on stuff like Antonio Inoki's matches, which were almost all works, or trying to find out information about just whatever, anything else anywhere in the world about anything that would help him figure out what mixed, well, I guess we'll call them, I was going to say mixed martial arts, but when the words were coming out of when the words were coming out of my mouth, I wasn't even using it in the, like, you know what I mean? My brain wasn't even thinking MMA like it is today. It was, you know, it was these various, you know, mixed styles fights, which, you know, of the major ones that I think would have been covered in English were probably mostly works. But he had done some incredible research into this, and that it impressed me just how much he was into it.
Yeah, it impressed me too. And you know, I tell everybody, the book grew out of our friendship, and Art and I have an amazing special friendship. You know, he's a generation older than me, but he's a friend like I've never had in my life. I spoke to him on the phone about an hour before we started this program. We speak 6-7 days a week. So that was a huge advantage, that we were already very close friends going into this book. But also, you got to remember, I'm a kid who had his mom in Shawnee, Kansas on November 12, 1993, plop down the 1495, and I watched it. Funny enough, I just actually made a DVD copy. I still have the original VHS, which I recorded, and I still have a VCR for the sole purpose of my old UFCs, and I just burned a DVD of UFC 1. It's tough to find. Not many people have seen the original broadcast, or at least they'll have a copy. What's out there is a serious cutdown that was put out in 1995 by Vidmark Home Entertainment. Mm-hmm. But the actual broadcast goes an hour and 58 minutes. I think Vidmark, their version is like 125. But you see the fights and the show and all of its glory and inglorious moments. But in writing the book, first and foremost, I wanted questions answered. So I'm coming in as the hardest of hardcore fans. How did you get these guys, Art? Why were you in Denver, Colorado? Why were you at McNichols Arena? Where did the Gracies come in? How did John Milius get mixed up in all this? How did you find Semaphore Entertainment Group? So peppering, and I'm not being funny, thousands and thousands of questions to get those answers. And Art's got an amazing memory. He's a prolific saver, as am I. And in the book, you know, we show original fighter contracts. We show the contract with Semaphore. We went in with the ground rules. Look, nothing is being held back. You're going to know every dollar figure, every fact. Everything is going to be laid out there, full documentation. You see the original facts in the book that Art Davies sent to Campbell McLaren, who was the head of acquisitions at Semaphore Entertainment Group, telling him about his idea for this mixed match fighting event, which puts to bed some of the stories that were spun, although I think our book has done a great job of quieting that, of people saying that maybe it was Semaphore who created it, or this person created it, or that. It's tough to argue with documentation, and we have all the documentation in the book.
Yeah, It answers pretty much any question that anyone would have about pretty much everything going into that first UFC, and really everything during and immediately after that first card.
I'm so proud of the fact that we laid this out. And, you know, Art and I said, look, this isn't an autobiography. It's not the story of your life. This isn't the autobiography or the biography of the UFC. This is the origin story of how this thing called the Ultimate Fighting Championship was conceived, by the man who conceived it, Art Davey, how we picked up all these people, including Horion Gracie, along the way, and how this came. And the book ends with the after party, November 13th, 1993, actually over after midnight into the wee hours. And that's where the book ends. It's the origin story. This is how our sport called mixed martial arts, even though Art Davey never gave it that name, didn't really even understand that he was creating a new sport. He was trying to create an event that would last a franchise, as Art calls it, but how this all came to be. And it's this story really of 4 years of Art Davey's life that he gave from the fall of 1989 through to fruition into the fall of 1993.
Yeah, and I think back to, I didn't see the first pay-per-view until it came out on home video in 95, like you said, because
I'll send you a DVD. I've been ripping these DVDs. I'll send you one. For real, I will.
I'm going to hold you to that. So I've never actually seen the pay-per-view version. I started with UFC 2, but what it was I didn't see that live. My dad was working at a TV syndication company, and he would always get just random stuff at work. And one day, he brought home the screener and press kit for UFC 2.
Outstanding.
And I was just... I was intrigued from the moment I saw Scott Morris's bloody face on the box and on the cover of the press kit. But, you know, once I watched it, even though, you know, some of the fights on that second UFC were a little longer and boring. I feel like Maybe it was either like one of those Orlando Weed or Johnny Rhodes fights.
Right.
I feel like I'm thinking of. But, just, you know, for like most people, it came down to seeing Hoist Gracie. And as a pro wrestling fan, seeing a guy doing grappling moves that looked a little bit like stuff you might see in pro wrestling, who was also this little guy and doing it off his back and stuff, you know, was the most intriguing part. And, you know, and then as the, you know, early UFCs went on, I mean, I think this is kind of, people don't talk about enough that the big change that came with regulation, etc. I like the relative grappling focus of the early UFCs in terms of what people who knew what they were doing were doing.
Well, you know, and David, Art says that a huge advantage, although he didn't realize it at the time, he wasn't a martial arts guy. He wasn't a fight guy. Now, he became very good friends with Horion Gracie, and he wound up getting his blue belt in Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And he had trained in a little bit in North Hollywood when he was living in L.A. as an advertising man in Muay Thai. And he did boxing and thought about the Golden Gloves as a kid. But he wasn't a devotee or a disciple of any one discipline. And one thing that I'm really proud that we put to bed, make no mistake, Horion Gracie wanted to showcase Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. He wanted his brother desperately to win. He wanted to honor his father, Elio. But Art Davey did not care. And Horion, largely out of the confidence of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, thinking that it was unbeatable, left the fighter recruitment, left the matchmaking all to Art Davey. Now, Jason DeLucio was a student who would come in, and Hoist actually beat him on a Gracie challenge, which you can find on YouTube, and that was a recommendation. Zane Frazier was a recommendation that Horion Gracie knew through Frank Trejo. But by and large, Art Davey was left to his own devices, find these fighters. And again, it was Horion Gracie's attitude, all the Gracies. We don't care who you bring in. It could be a boxer. It could be a Sambo guy. It could be an Olympic wrestler. Doesn't matter. Gracie Jiu-Jitsu is going to smash everybody. So while Horion clearly wanted what happened to happen with the Gracie name exploding in his younger brother Hoist, Art Davey also wanted to have happen what happened, which is that the UFC became a franchise. That's how he envisioned it. So they both wanted success, but they were looking at different paths of success for much different reasons.
Yeah, and it's weird. You know, looking back, it this is a broken record because everyone talks about this. Joe Rogan talks about it all the time, that just how quickly everything changed in terms of people's perceptions, that, you know, all of a sudden you just look at who won the early tournaments, especially, you know, once Hoist bowed out of the UFC. But you go from Hoist, then you have Severn and Oleg Taktarov, and Ken Shamrock had his, you know, the super fight titles and all that, and it's, you know, and Marco Huas, was having success with striking, but he also had his own, you know, that sort of catch wrestling inspired lucha libre grappling. And it's not till and Don Fry and Mark Coleman were winning with their grappling and using it to really get ground and pound. Really everyone anyone thinks of from the early tournaments was a grappler, though. And there's something I miss about it, just, and the way that, I don't. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, and just seeing like Hackney breaking his hand, and then everyone realizing, hey, maybe you shouldn't try to punch someone in the head 35 times in the same fight.
I think what we're talking about, David, is that there was no culture of mixed martial arts.
Oh yeah,
and so Art Jimmerson coming in with one boxing glove, and we tell the story that Art Jimmerson didn't bring boxing gloves; he wanted it, and Art Davey, the day of the fight, had to send his kid brother Matthew out to a sporting goods store in the nearby Denver suburb of Arvada, Colorado. Those were boxing gloves off the store shelf. You know, I've used this analogy, and I think it fits. What Art Jimmerson did against Hoist Gracie is literally like showing up at Wimbledon for your first round match with a baseball bat going, what court am I on? Just no idea. You know, Pat Smith saying I'm impervious to pain, getting caught in a heel hook. He didn't even know what a heel hook was. He didn't even know that that concept existed. So there was no culture of mixed martial arts. The idea of martial arts were your own little kingdom, your own little fiefdom. What everybody else does is garbage. What we do is real. So if you're in Taekwondo, you're not paying attention to Muay Thai. If you're in Muay Thai, you're not paying attention to Jiu-Jitsu. If you're in Jiu-Jitsu, you're not paying attention to Sambo, and it goes on and on. Everybody was locked in their own little bubble. There was just no conceptual awareness of anything else because you're only training in your style against other practitioners of your style.
Yeah, and even just as a spect- you know, as a fan who wasn't, you know, any kind of martial artist or anything, I kind of miss just the kind of sense of wonder that we had during the early shows, especially seeing stuff like voice triangling Severn, you know, after, you know, just kind of slowly working at it that whole fight, you know, and with Jeff Blatnick's very surprise and confusion calling it, and Oleg Taktarov in the tournament that he won at UFC 6 pulling out that, you know, that beautiful rolling knee bar, just all that stuff for the first time. Like, we still see new techniques, but I don't think there's anything that'll ever impress us as much as things did, like you said, when there was no mixed martial arts community or anything in the early UFCs.
Yeah, you can't put toothpaste back in the tube. A television producer friend of mine was about a year ago, was telling me an idea he had. He was like, yeah, I'm going to get a guy from kickboxing. I'm going to get a guy from boxing. I'm going to get a guy from judo. I was like, yeah, kind of like what Art Davey did in 1993. I said, you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube. So you get a guy who's an Olympic judoka. So you're going to say, all right, I'm going to put you in this free fight tournament. But don't go to an MMA gym. God forbid. Don't learn any jiu-jitsu. Don't work with a striking coach. Things happen, and then that time moves on. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan. And yesterday on Howard Stern, it was an interview with Clay Aiken, the runner-up from season 2 of American Idol. And believe me, I'm going somewhere with this story. So Clay Aiken was saying to Stern, you can't recapture the magic of those early days of American Idol on Idol or any reality show, because they had no concept of what reality shows were like. They didn't know how many people were watching. They hadn't seen the show. They weren't savvy. There was no performance. Now, if you're on American Idol, if you're on The Voice or America's Got Talent, you've been watching these shows for years. You've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of these performances, judges, critiques. Clay Aiken shows up at season 2. He has no conceptual awareness of how to play this game. Just like these fighters are showing up in the early UFCs, they had no conceptual awareness of anything else that was happening. It's just an era that was there and it's gone. And no matter how much anybody wishes they wanted to come back or tries to make it come back, it's not going to come back. You can't tell someone, don't go cross training, don't go grapple, don't go work with your Muay Thai coach, don't go hire a wrestling coach. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
Yeah, and this isn't really on point to what you're saying, but I always, like, that made me just think of that. I always kind of try to remind people sometimes, like, when, like, talking about, like, the early reality shows and stuff, people don't remember that when Survivor happened, because Survivor was the show that really kind of got the boom going.
Right.
Survivor was kind of conceived as a game show coming out of that brief game show boom. After Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, it was not conceived as this new type of programming or as something patterned after the real world.
And all the early Survivor cast. Right. And David, all the early Survivor cast members, and Clay Aiken talked about this on Stern as well, had never seen an episode of Survivor. So they didn't really understand the machinations of the show.
Right. Like, no one had any idea of, oh, well, form an alliance with these other contestants and and then it kind of came organically in the first season, but then, you know, and then the second season or whatever, depending on if someone had watched the show yet, and maybe they hadn't.
It's, you know, and Art Davey and I talk about this all the time, part of the magic of the early UFCs and then early MMA was the unpredictability. I remember watching those shows, and you would hear a guy, and he was from some fighting discipline that I had never heard of. Wow, what's he going to bring? What's this going to do? Well, what's he going to be like? You know, I watched my 9-year-old daughter, Ellie, who does Muay Thai, and we're big on 1980s movies. We just watched Blues Brothers, and about 6 months ago, as part of her indoctrination, we watched Bloodsport, which she hated, by the way. But, you know, Bloodsport came out in 1988, so I was an impressionable kid. That's what we thought fighting was. Spinning back fist and flying through the air. Nobody grapples. Nobody grapples in Bloodsport. Guys get knocked down. Nobody puts their hooks in, fishes for the choke. It's all standing and banging and spinning strikes and flying through the air. That's what people thought that fighting was. And Jim Brown, who's just awful on UFC 1, but we put this in the book. He said one thing really profound. The only thing profound he said on the entire broadcast, he said, fighting is not what we thought it was. And that is so true.
I think Jim Brown does get a little bit of a bad rap for those shows, though. Like, he's not a good announcer, but you could tell he legitimately did get into what was going on. And then especially, you know, there's that famous line at the end of the tournament final with Severn and Hoyce at UFC 4 where, you know, the whole fight, Jeff Blatnick is talking about how Severn has Gracie right where he wants him. All of a sudden, he taps to the triangle, and then Jim Brown says to him, "You don't ever say anything to me about wrestling again."
That's right. That's right. I had the great honor, and I use that word lightly, honor, to meet Dan Severn in November at the Legends of MMA Hall of Fame dinner in Reno. I was there as the presenter of Art Davey, who was being inducted, and Severn was there as a guest speaker. And I introduced myself. Severn looks awesome. I mean, he still looks like he should be fighting, and he was basically just fighting a couple of months ago. But I think Dan's 52 or 53, and he fought till he was 51, I believe.
Well, and he's still doing indie wrestling.
Exactly. The guy looks amazing. He literally hasn't aged in 20 years. But I asked him about that fight, which is one of my all-time favorite fights, just for the historical significance. And he said, it was like Pat Smith with the heel hook. I didn't know what a triangle was. I had no idea. You know, if you watch that fight, as we both have many times, you know, he postures up. He does the exact opposite thing of what you should do when you're caught in a triangle, because he didn't know there was such a thing as a triangle choke. There was no conceptual awareness of it. You can't try to escape a dangerous submission hold if you don't know it's a submission hold and you don't know you're in danger. And again, that's where the toothpaste isn't going back in the tube.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about current MMA, obviously your job in Bellator, et cetera, so before we finish up. Also your podcast that you've been doing now with John McCarthy for, I guess, it's about 2 months?
We've just done 8 episodes, and I'm having a blast. I started in this business in radio at 18 years old, and it feels like radio to me. It is so much fun. About a year ago, I was, through my agent, pitching around doing an MMA hour to Sirius and CBS Radio and NBC Radio. Sirius was like, "We have too many MMA shows." The others were like, "We hate MMA. Leave us alone. Come back when you have a basketball idea." And John and I were pitched this podcast, and basically, be yourselves, go for about an hour and give us a show once a week. And I'm having a blast. You know firsthand how much fun podcasts are.
Yeah. So I guess from listening to the podcast, it kind of ties into something I wanted to ask you anyway. Now, it's starting to seem to be like after like almost every Bellator card, especially if something weird happens, like has happened on the last couple cards, that I'll text you a compliment on just how well you and Jimmy Smith explain the rules compared to really any other MMA announcing team. And obviously now from listening to the podcast you've been doing with John, that seems to be something that you're kind of, I mean this in the most complimentary way possible, kind of a geek on.
Completely.
How did that, so it seemed like, was that something more, I want to brush up on this and be as familiar with this as possible for my announcing, or just kind of being geeky about that aspect of it, or both?
No, it's both. And I became a pro boxing referee when I was 24 years old. And this is before the John McCain Legislation Act, the Boxing Reform Act, where you have things like the ABC and national databases and ID cards and state commissions. So literally, I was friends with the promoter. He said, "Why don't you box?" I said, "No, because I don't really know how to box and I'll probably get my nose busted." And he goes, "Why don't you referee?" And I go, "Okay." And he gave me $50 and I referee. And I just tried to be a tall Mills Lane, who was my hero. That was my indoctrination. But if I do anything, I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. So I wound up going to Mills Lane seminar and Dwayne Ford's judging seminar and throwing myself into it. Then when I started commentating boxing, I realized that by having been a referee before a commentator, it made me a lot better. So as I moved into MMA, I kept that same ethos, and I've become close friends with some A-level referees, John McCarthy, Rob Hines, Kevin McDonald, Jason Herzog. I want to know everything that they know. There's no excuse as a commentator to be unprepared. As a commentator, some people are going to like you, some people aren't. It's just like no one's going to agree on who's the best-looking woman in the world. No matter who you and I think is the best-looking woman in the world, someone's going to go, she's kind of ugly. It's just the way the world works. So there's not going to be universality in who's beloved as a commentator. Can't control that. You can control your knowledge and your preparation. So nothing is going to happen in the cage that I'm going to be caught out on, and I'm going to make sure of that. So I want to know everything that those guys know, and I do want to be a rules geek. I've just always been interested in that part of it too, rules, procedures. Even when I was a soccer commentator, I did, and we talked about this on the podcast a couple weeks ago, I went and I trained with the U.S. Soccer Federation and the Canadian Soccer Association, their top officials. I just wanted to see what they experienced and what they were like. So it's a bit of my personality, but it definitely makes me a better commentator, and it certainly makes me a more competent and more confident commentator. And I appreciate you noticing that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, just got another couple minutes. So I kind of, I guess, don't have too much time to go into anything else, too in-depth, but I did want to ask you, I guess, kind of something coming off of the whole rules thing, and also from the perspective of now doing the podcast with John and also doing refereeing, although not in MMA, because I know you talk about how you feel that would be a little bit of a conflict of interest if someone came to Bellator later on. So we've had some odd refereeing incidents lately, more in UFC. I mean, just I think by virtue of them running more shows,
right?
As opposed to, you know, because they're using, you know, like Bellator, they're using the commission referees. Except for, you know, when they do the international cards. But, you know, a few times with Jaron Vallel, and then also the thing with Eduardo Hurdy that you talked about extensively on the podcast, and I forget which episode number it is. I think it was 6 or 7 that you discussed that recently. People should check that specific episode out, because it was very, you know, listen to all of them, but especially that one was good about explaining what the referee should be doing. But anyway, about the Eduardo Hurdy incident where he called the choke that wasn't there. So anyway,
on the Drew Dober fight, Leandro Silva, Drew Dober fight in Brazil. Absolutely.
Right. So what the thing that's kind of striking me in all of this is that we have referees who clearly know jiu-jitsu. Both guys are legitimate black belts. Hurdy has competed in MMA. Jaron Vallel is, you know, has done a lot of jiu-jitsu, legitimate jiu-jitsu competitions. They know jiu-jitsu. So is it, and I wouldn't even say they're even incompetent referees or anything like that. Do you think this is just more of a mental lapse thing than anything else?
Yeah, I sometimes think it's nerves. I mean, you can't discount the fact of being on worldwide TV, having fans there, having the pressure. You know, I come from a position that even the worst judges and referees have their heart in the right place. They may not have the education or the knowledge or the training or the ability, but they're not there to wreck a fight or to wreck somebody's career. They just maybe don't have that level of proficiency or competency. I haven't seen Eduardo Hurdy enough to have a real strong opinion. I have a strong opinion on Jaron Vallel. I think he's an outstanding referee. Like everybody, including John McCarthy, has been caught in some bad situations, and John will be the first to acknowledge that. It's so blown up now because of the MMA media, of social media, of podcasts like you do, like I do, that we're drawing attention to things that maybe wouldn't have been had the attention drawn to them 10 years ago. A lot of it, though, is just nerves. It's getting caught having to make a split-second decision. You know, watch the NFL. The NFL spends more money, more resources on their officiating than anybody else. Every single play is reviewed for every single official on the field. If you're the side judge, you have someone evaluating every single play of every game that you did just as the side judge. It's crazy. And there are still mistakes being made in the NFL. I just think it's human nature. But I'm for not just education, continuing education. You know, we've been talking about old school MMA. If you're refereeing or judging the way you were in 1995, good luck, because nobody's fighting the way they were in 1995. Referees, judges are put in tough positions. I just, as an optimistic person, like to think that everybody's heart is in the right place. But yeah, there definitely are some sketchy decisions. And we're going to talk about John and I on our podcast this week about the thing with Luis Sapo Santos and Ben Askren. That was a disaster. And we're going to get into it. We're not going to pick on anybody. Olivier Costa was the referee. We're not there to give him a hatchet job or make him feel bad. But as we say, we separate fact from fiction. And who better than the dean of MMA referees, John McCarthy, and then to explain the situation. And John always has that humbleness, that humility to bring up things that he could have done better at.
So I know you've got to go. So I'd really like to thank you for doing this. This has been a lot of fun. Absolutely.
And David, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. I'd be happy to come on again anytime. You're always so supportive of me, and really, it's a pleasure. You do a great show, man. Do great work.
And like with the UFC DVD, I will hold you to that, and thank you. So plugs, do you want me to go through them or should you?
No, I'm happy to do it. Thank you. So my book is called Is This Legal? The Inside Story of the First UFC from the Man Who Created It by Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock. If you go to our publisher, it's the best price. Buy direct from our publisher, Ascend Books, ASCENDbooks.com. Use the promo code LEGAL5050 and buy it for $12.48. The ebook, I think, is $8 or $9 on Amazon. You can buy the hardcover on Amazon for under $20. You can find the book in store as well, nationwide across the U.S. at Barnes & Noble. Podcast is called Let's Get It On. iTunes, Android, the Stitcher app, Let's Get It On Podcast.com. You can listen right there. You can subscribe. And, of course, Bellator MMA next up on Spike Friday, May 15th.
Yeah, May 15th with main event Brandon Halsey in his first middleweight title defense against Kendall Grove, which I'm looking forward to. That should be a really fun fight because I think Halsey's got that kind of a fast-paced wrestling style, but Grove is always kind of trying to grab things on the ground. So I expect that to be kind of one of those fun kind of ground-based fights. And also Eduardo Dantas versus Mike Richmond on that same card should be absolutely excellent fight. And then on that's May 15th. And then on June 19th, you've got the next quarterly tentpole show, Ken Shamrock against Kimbo Slice in the main event in a fight that's several years in the making. And that's a loaded card because you've also got Patricio Pitbull against Georgi Karakanyan for the featherweight title, plus Michael Chandler against Derek Campos in Michael Chandler's first fight since the loss to Will Brooks. And Bobby Lashley makes his return against James Thompson in another fight that's been a while in the making. So a lot of fun stuff coming up from Bellator in the next couple months.
Stack cards, I'm telling you. I lead a charmed life. It's a privilege. I never lose sight of that.
All right. So I'd like to thank Sean for doing this and like to thank everyone for listening. We will be back next week with another show. And that's about it. So go to, if you're listening via iTunes or whatever, it's davidbix.com. And all my other stuff, my ebooks, my Amazon affiliates account, my Patreon, etc., that's all there. I have more details about that on the site. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And I'll be back with you soon. Bix. Show!